The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is Bob Metzger. Bob is an attorney who heads up the Washington office of Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, a firm that specializes in government contracts. Been around for about 35 years or so, is that correct, Bob?
Yep, a little more than 35 years.
And today we're going to be talking about cybersecurity and some new DFARS requirements. And there's no one better to have on the show than Bob Metzger. He is named Federal Computer Week Fed 100 winner for his work on convergence of supply chain and cybersecurity. Bob also serves as a special government employee for the Department of Defense. He is a member of the Defense Science Board's task force that produced a cyber supply chain report earlier this year. So, Bob, I'm looking forward to this topic. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Roger.
Well, yes, and what we're going to be focusing on is an area where I know a lot of companies have asked us about and are trying to understand the new requirements, this DFARS clause, and I'm going to give the number at least once, you know, to be geeky, but it's 252.204-7012, Safeguarding Covered Defense Information and Cyber Incident Reporting. It implements NIST SP 800-171, the cyber controls that was issued, I guess, and it has to be done by December 31st.
Yeah, the standard itself was issued in 2016. It was revised in December of 2016 to add a very important 110th control, which I'm sure we'll be talking about. That control is one that requires companies to prepare a system security plan. And we'll see that it figures in a most important fashion in compliance with both the DFARS and the 171 standard.
Okay. Well, and thanks for that introduction. I should have turned it over to you earlier, Bob, for that. But so let's just start with this new rule and new clause. And what is DoD trying to accomplish with it?
Well, it's important for everyone looking at this clause to step back from the mechanics and the seeming burdens or the uncertainties to understand the history and the purpose, and it can be distilled pretty simply. Over a period of years, the United States government has suffered the loss by theft, by economic espionage, by unauthorized exfiltration of literally billions of dollars worth of technical data from its supply chain. Everyone knows that the Department of Defense invests an enormous amount on its supply chain to develop and to build systems and networks. Unfortunately, the experience of the last decade has shown that many of those contractor networks and systems are porous. And so adversaries ranging from nation states to organized criminal activities have done exceptionally well in stealing that information. And there are a number of adverse consequences to the U.S. First, adversaries may be able to mimic the capabilities that were paid for at taxpayer expense.
Would that be something like, you know, our F-35? And it's funny how Chinese have a plane that looks a lot like that, has the same capabilities.
There's
funny how that happens.
There are Chinese aircraft that seem to have the same outer mold line and other configuration attributes that are awfully similar to ours. The Chinese equivalent to the Humvee multipurpose vehicle looks similar to ours. Chinese unmanned aerial systems, drones, look similar to ours. The exposure is not just that adversaries will take information to blunt U.S. military advantage or to replicate U.S. capabilities. But it's also possible that nation states will sponsor or at least permit commercial enterprises or criminal enterprises to hack into contractor systems, because it can be the advantage of other powers to have companies that are located on their soil to be able to get to market faster than the U.S. So One thing to consider here is this. These are special requirements and a contract obligation that defense contractors have to accept. But the purpose that DOD seeks to achieve, that is, to improve the protection of sensitive but unclassified information, in many cases is the same objective that a responsible enterprise would take to protect its own intellectual property.
So, and I have a, and just as a layperson, sensitive but unclassified information. So what is that? I mean,
that's a good question. So, you know, in the government world, of course, you know, there's an instruction, a rule, a process, and a procedure for everything.
Absolutely. Otherwise, we wouldn't have jobs, right,
we wouldn't
Bob?
Be here. So, you know, over a period of years, most companies in the defense supply chain have become familiar with something that the government calls controlled technical information. That's information of military or space significance. And there's a long history of attempts to protect CTI. But over the last several years, other parts of the government have made increased efforts to identify, designate, and protect different types of information which under federal law, whether by statute, regulation, or government-wide policy, require protection. Now, the federal law that underlies this for civilian agencies and which applies in certain respects to DOD is FISMA, which many listeners will know, now the Federal Information Systems and Modernization Act.
Yep.
And FISMA essentially tells federal agencies that they have to categorize information in order to consider the impact of a breach on each of confidentiality, integrity, and availability. Well, FISMA includes all forms of what are now described as controlled unclassified information. These controlled unclassified information is the domain of a different federal agency, the National Archives and Records Administration, or NARA. NARA produced a final rule a year or so ago in which it established 23 categories and 84 subcategories of CUI. Controlled technical information is one of those categories. Now, I go through all of this because there's a really important point. The present version of the DOD cyber regulation, this 7012 DFAR, as you mentioned, it requires DOD contractors at all levels of the supply chain to safeguard not just controlled technical information, but also any other form of CUI as it is described on the registry of CUI that NARA maintains. And that is that expansion has caused a lot of uncertainty and concern among the contracting community. Happily, in just recent weeks, DOD has taken some steps to clarify that the only CUI that contractors must protect is that which the department...
Remind folks what CUI is.
No, CUI is controlled and classified information. Yeah. That could be geospatial information, agriculture, export controlled. It could be PII, personally identifiable information, public health information, other information subject to privacy controls. Mm-hmm. What DOD has said is this. It's our job as the department to identify and designate and tell you on a contract which information is CDI. So if we give you information and you have to protect it by this cyber DFARS, we're going to tell you what it is. Or if we buy the information from you, if we pay you to develop and deliver it, we're going to tell you what information that you deliver has to be protected and how you are to market. Now, that's helpful because it narrows the span. It doesn't leave contractors guessing quite so much as to what is covered and what is not. And yet, as is true with all things involving the Department of Defense, for every rule, there's, you know, one, several, or many exceptions.
Oh, of course. Right. And in multiple internal guidances or whatever, right?
Right.
I was just thinking about that. Like, how, you know, on a program-by-program basis, people could have different
If it were just program-by-program, it would be hard enough, but it's actually
component-by-component. Yes, okay.
The Missile Defense Agency, and I'm not speaking out of school, the Missile Defense Agency has said in public fora that it doesn't quite see it that way. Its basic view is that any company that does any contract with the Missile Defense Agency will treat everything that it gets from MDA and delivers to MDA and uses in support of MDA contracts as subject to this rule. Beyond that, individual requiring activities can put in solicitations provisions that expand the scope of CDI beyond just what is designated.
Right.
And some do. DOD recognizes that there are many different programs, many different types of information. And the key actor in this scheme, not well understood by many, is something called the requiring activity. The requiring activity is essentially above the program office. Requiring activity is the part within DOD that ultimately is the source of the demand and potentially the user for a system or product.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And the requiring activity has the right, if not the responsibility, to assess the kinds of information it provides to and gets from its contractors, and then to evaluate the risk of sharing that information with particular contractors and their suppliers. Some requiring activities may be much more demanding in what they expect contractors to do, first to demonstrate performance to 171, and potentially, although this is not seen too often yet, potentially requiring activities can ask contractors to do more to provide additional protection for high-impact information on critical programs.
Right. So, Bob, we do have to take a break, but that the Missile Defense Agency,
MDA.
MDA. That strikes me as an easy solution, right? It's like everything. You protect everything. It's better safe than sorry. And also, I guess it's, in some ways for the government, it's a little less work, right? Because they don't have to parse or decide or not.
I'll answer it simply. I'm not sure it's a better solution because...
I'm not saying it's a better solution. I mean, from their perspective,
their perspective, I suppose it produces less doubt. But
yes.
Security is not free. Covering more things is more expensive.
Yeah. Great
Finding
point.
More things that you've accumulated historically is more expensive. Putting more pressure on or attempting to manage or supervise your subcontractors is more expensive. And it is not always, if ever, clear that the government buyers are willing to pay the additional cost, both non-recurring and recurring, of this special requirement of security.
Right. Well, Bob, we do have to take our first break. My guest today is Bob Metzger from Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, and we're talking about the new cyber rules that DOD has put out. And when we come back, we'll talk about what the contractors must do by December 31st, 2017, which is coming right up, to be in compliance. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Bob Metzger from Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, and we're talking about the new DFARS clause, safeguarding covered defense information and cyber incident reporting, and what it means for DOD, for the government, and what it means for contractors. And Bob, this segment, let's start talking about the what contractors need to do, what they need to know, and what they need to do. You've got a deadline coming up of December 31st, 2017 for compliance.
All right. Well, this is a key question that obviously is occupying the attention, if not generating anxiety, among a lot of companies. But it isn't quite as difficult, perhaps, as some may think. First, I want to summarize what are the four purposes that DOD expects you to fulfill. One is safeguards. The second is that you have a mechanism in place to report cyber incidents within 72 hours of discovery. The third is that you agree that you'll cooperate in the event of a cyber breach, that you'll provide any malware that you've collected, and you will support a forensic investigation. And the fourth is that you'll flow down. So let's kind of think about what has to happen by December 31st. DOD recognizes that not all companies that are subject to this rule, and some estimates are that 10,000 companies are subject to this rule, DOD recognizes that not all companies are in fact going to complete the changes to their information technology system, the adjustments to policy and procedure, the implementation of new hardware or software. Not all companies are going to get all of that done to be in literal full compliance with the 110 safeguards by December 31st. But what DOD does expect is that by December 31st, every company will have completed and documented what's called a system security plan. Now, despite the formal label, the SSP as is applied through this regulation does not have to meet any prescribed format or formula. It essentially is up to the contractor in its own judgment to decide how to prepare and what to document in an SSP. And the basic approach to the SSP is fairly straightforward. You should look at the 110 safeguards, assess which ones require changes to policy or procedure, which ones might need implementation in your existing IT systems, where you might need new software, such as improved virus responses or new hardware, such as a digital firewall. And then the crucial concept is that you assess what you have, you understand where there are gaps versus the 110 safeguards. You have a plan to mitigate the vulnerabilities you've found and to close those gaps, and then you document that plan and pursue it over the time that you need. No one has to complete all of the 110 requirements by December 31st, unless your particular purchaser insists that you do. What you must have is that documented plan, the documented system security plan, including the self-assessment with a plan of action. And if you have that, well, then you are in compliance. But appreciate this. You're not obligated to send your SSP or your plan to anyone. It's not in the ordinary course expected that you'll be that it will be reviewed by anyone. This is a self-preparation, self-attestation. Purchasers do have the right to see it, and we may see examples in particular acquisitions where they assess it for adequacy or even review it in a competitive, in a source selection process. But basically, the job is internal. You prepare it, you have it, you do it, and the test would be only if there's some event later where it could become under scrutiny. And before we move to the next question, I do want to emphasize another part of initial compliance. Companies that receive this clause have to have in place the means to report to DoD a cyber incident. And so it's expected that they will acquire something called a medium assurance certificate, which enables them to communicate cyber event information to something called DC3, which is the Defense Computer Crime Center. And there are some technical aspects to that. And there are ways in which you can report without going through DC3 and without the certificate. But everyone trying to fulfill both the letter and the spirit of the regulation should understand that DoD wants to both safeguard information, but DoD also needs to know when the confidentiality of information has been compromised, because DoD wants to assess the impact of that compromise upon its military systems and readiness. And DoD also wants to learn what it can from the actual attack event so that it can help mitigate or defend against similar attacks.
Right. So so you have to have a plan in place. One of my follow-up question is there's no thought of extending the due date or changing it in any way?
There have been a number of trade associations and different components of the defense industry that have sought postponement, relief, change, alteration, or exception from the rule. And DoD is certainly aware of that. However, as I mentioned at the outset, the experience is all too painful in the amount, quality, and value of the data that has been stolen from the defense supply chain. That isn't to say that federal agencies do a perfect job protecting information themselves. We all know that they don't.
OPM.
Right, OPM would be just one of several examples.
So I have personal stake in that one.
Most people listening to this have probably had one or another unfortunate experience. However, yes. You know, in the DoD continues to feel, at least in my appraisal, that it is important to improve security among its contractors. It is not expecting perfection. It understands that it is making it harder for adversaries to steal information, it's reducing vulnerability, mitigating impact, but it's not going to eliminate the threat. There will continue to be such cyber breaches. So I don't think we're going to see any postponement in the deadline. In fact, just recently, the Shay Assad, who is the Director of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy, issued a letter on September 21st, which is intended for the acquisition community, but really communicates key principles to contractors. And the most important principle is something I referenced earlier, namely that what DoD expects now for compliance is that you complete the system security plan, and that you have this medium assurance certificate and are prepared to report within 72 hours. You may decide in the course of documenting that plan that it will take you 2 years to complete all of its requirements. Many companies, Roger, find that the most difficult single requirement is something called multi-factor authentication. Well, DoD doesn't expect you to have all that locked up and in place and running on December 31st. If your plan says that you need until January 1st, 2018, or even 2019 to get that done, well, you know, you've complied by essentially understanding your security situation, documenting it, and coming up with a plan to close the gaps, mitigate the risks over a period of time.
Right. Okay. And we're already up on the break, Bob, in this segment. And I do have to remind you that January 1st, 2018 is the day after December 31st,
right.
2017.
Yeah,
I couldn't resist.
Much relief.
No.
But the point is important. This is not a situation where DOD is going to ascend any assessor or accreditation reviewer or approving agencies. DCMA is not now trained to consider the quality or sufficiency of your plans. DCMA may ask to see that you have it. DCMA may ask you to show that you have that medium assurance certificate, but there is no federal cyber workforce that's going to descend upon any contractor to review the SSP and consider its sufficiency. A particular requiring activity could make that a requirement in a solicitation, but if they're going to consider it in the acquisition process, they have to inform you. They have to tell you,
right.
And they have to be willing to discuss it with you so that you're not surprised.
All right. Well, we have to take our break. My guest today is Bob Metzger. He is with Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, and we're talking about the new cybersecurity rules for DOD, the new DFARS clause. When you come back, talk a little bit about the NIST standard. Why is DOD using it? What does it mean? And also just philosophically, it's interesting, the description, Bob, that you've given about this the security plan and it having one in place and just the evolving nature of, you know, the threat. And it seems to me reflects an evolving nature to the security plan over time. And just what does that mean for contractors? You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Bob Metzger from Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, and we're talking cybersecurity. And Bob, when we took the break, we were talking about the system security plans and what they mean and what contractors have to do by December 31st, 2017.
Right.
And it just strikes me as what you described. There's that ongoing requirement, and you know the way threats evolve over time. What do contractors need to think about when they're putting together a plan that regard?
Let's begin with the resources that you use to create a plan. You certainly want to involve your existing information technology personnel. If you have a chief security officer, chief information officer, you'd involve them. But many companies, especially smaller ones, won't have that. Now, DOD has said that it's not going to accept any third-party assessment or purported accreditation or certification. However, the truth is that many companies can only go so far to prepare a system security plan or to implement improvements without using some form of outside expert resource. That could be a technical consultant, a software consultant, somebody who could help you install hardware, somebody who could help maintain the software and update it as experience is gained with threats and response. That said, though, we have to look back at the clause for a moment. 7012 is the compliance clause. And it says that by December 31st, you have to be in compliance with this 171 set of safeguards. But it also says that you have to deliver adequate security on a continuing basis, reflecting a dynamic assessment, a reasonable assessment of the dynamic conditions, the changing conditions that may affect your security, your exposure, your vulnerability, and so forth. And so the system security plan is a crucial starting point, but it's not the end point. Companies should be careful not to believe that having prepared a plan once, they have checked the box and they need not do anything more over time. In fact, having prepared a plan, companies need to continually assess the security situation, learn from experience, and from time to time improve the plan and document the improvements.
So Yeah, I just put my government contracts hat on for a second as a lawyer, you know, and both when I was in government and then outside government. And, you know, it's interesting. You've talked a little bit about this in the other segments, just in terms of how does the government, how is the government assured that a contractor is complying with this, and that, you know, we, you know, the government doesn't have like a cybersecurity force to come in, you know, of inspectors or auditors, I guess, to come in and take a look at that. And to also look at that key part of the, you know, continuing to do a review and update as appropriate, given the dynamic changes and, you know, the cyber threat. How do you see this, like, you know, sort of evolving over time? It's interesting because what you've described, it is like sort of a self-certification approach, and you promise to do it. You know,
but it can be more. And there are risks if you don't do it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about it. Look, there's 10,000 companies subject to this rule. Now, some people at the smaller end of the supply chain would say, gee, this is hardest for me. I have the least resources, the smallest business base, and so forth. I don't want to do it. The problem is that the adversaries know that some of the smaller companies in the supply chain are those that are most vulnerable exactly because they don't have the existing investment and control. And yet the truth is that small businesses in a vast number of examples do create or possess technical information of extraordinary value. So they become the targets of opportunity. And some of those small businesses really are indispensable from a technical standpoint, not to mention any regulatory obligation. So let's talk about kind of what the government does. Well, first, the government does have the right to put into Section H of an RFP that it wants to see your system security plan. In fact, the government can include the system security plan as a contract obligation, as an attachment in a contract, and we'll start to see that. Because if the government wants to hold you to your assessment and the plan of action, well, they can't really do that if they've never seen the plan or assessed it, if it's just a general, you know, inclusion of the reg. So in some cases of higher impact or sensitivity, we will see a requiring activity asked to include your plan as a contract obligation. We will also see situations, and the regulations and guidance expressly contemplate this, where the government will say, we want to see your plan and we want to discuss it with you before we make a selection decision, and we are going to review it for adequacy. And if it's inadequate, you will not be eligible for award. And in fact, the government has the right, and has said so again in guidance and instructions, to consider, if you will, the quality of your plan as an evaluation factor in a competitive procurement. And we haven't seen too many examples of that yet, but they are coming, because some of the requiring activities are not going to be satisfied just with your checking the box and saying you prepared an SSP. Some are going to want to evaluate that SSP to be sure they are comfortable with the risk of sharing their technical information with you, a contractor, given your particular security risk. Now, beyond that, the DCMA, of course, does have some oversight responsibility. Already, it's been given the assignment that will cause it to at least ask contractors under its supervision if they have a plan. Now, it can't evaluate the sufficiency, as I said, but it may want to see that plan just to confirm that it exists. Sure. And the DCMA will ask whether contractors have that medium assurance certificate to make the reports I described. But beyond all that, we have to appreciate that the compliance may really be put under test after an adverse event. Because when you make a report, it's not just that your report and any malware you furnish kind of go into a black box and you never hear from it. There are, in fact, instructions and guidance and procedures that are publicly available that have been shared within DoD's acquisition and compliance community. If you make a report of a breach, the government is going to look at the nature of the information compromised. If the impact is serious, the government is very likely to look at your system security plan. Even if it's never seen it before, it will ask for it, and it has a right to. And then it may assess whether your system security plan was adequate. Well, and if you include a plan of action, it may assess whether you were performing to that plan.
Right, yeah.
And if you weren't, or if your system security plan was just a sham, well, then you're exposed to a number of adverse consequences, breach of contract could be won.
Civil False Claims Act?
Civil False Claims Act. It hasn't happened yet, but I've seen some, you know, attempts and some relator complaints to say, in effect, that when you submit a bid for a contract and you represent that you will be in compliance, that's in the 7008 clause, or you take a clause with the 7012 clause that promises compliance. When you
right.
do that,
yeah.
a condition of your being eligible to receive the contract is your promise of delivering that security. Now, it's not as easy a case as it might think because the nature of these requirements, should have mentioned this earlier, the NIST 171 standard includes 110 safeguards. Sounds like a lot.
And it sure does.
Except when you look at those safeguards, what you realize is that each of the 110 is expressed in a single sentence. And you can collect all of the 110 there and print them in about three pages. And the 110 distill into roughly 14 families of security controls. And most organizations of any sophistication already are going to have in place security procedures and equipment to address many, if not all, of those families, even if they use somewhat different techniques.
So then this standard, so who, you know, one of the, when you're describing that, you know, one of the questions that I wanted to ask you just generally is, so where, you know, the government is you know, adopt, is issued these clauses, you have the NIST standards, is the government approach ahead of, at the same pace as commercial approaches to cybersecurity? Is the government taking advantage of the commercial? You know, I always hear commercial best practices, and as
those are great questions. As to ahead, no. As yes. to same place, hopefully. As to commercial, yes. As to advantage,
well, we'll have to.
Yes.
We'll have
but to, I'll explain.
Yeah, we'll explain. That's good. We'll come back to those questions when we come back from the break. That's perfect. I like the way you did that, Bob. My guest today is Bob Metzger. He is a partner at Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, and we're talking about the new cybersecurity requirements for DoD contractors. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Bob Metzger. He is with the law firm Rogers Joseph O'Donnell. We're talking cybersecurity. And Bob, you do serve as a special government employee for the Defense Science Board. You're working on these cybersecurity issues. So I know you want to make sure you put the disclaimer in there. So I'll give you that opportunity.
Because I am a special government employee of the Department of Defense, I am obliged to give a disclaimer, which is that I am expressing here my personal views. And nothing that I say should be attributed to the Defense Science Board or the Department of Defense, or for that matter, to any client who I may represent or organization with whom I may work.
Well, okay, we got that all cleared up. We're covered. You're covered now.
Phew.
And when we took the break, you answered the questions very succinctly.
Yes.
Okay. So
but I'll save you from having to reconstruct.
Okay.
So you asked a really critical question, in effect, was what's the relationship between these 110 safeguards and NIST SP 800-171 and commercial practices? It's a crucial question because 171 was the product of a very intense effort by NIST involving people from DoD and NARA to create a set of cybersecurity objectives that were intended for commercial and other non-federal enterprises. NIST knows very well how to create, document, describe, and prescribe security practices
sure.
for federal organizations. Some of you listening will have heard of SP 853. Well, that's about 500 pages long in its present iteration. And it gives you not only chapter and verse, but the equivalent of, you know, footnotes, subtext, and variations. That's not 171. The strategy and objective of 171 is to make maximum use of existing commercial practices. The idea is to give a list of 110 goals or performance objectives allocated into 14 categories, which all make sense: incident response, awareness and training, access control. The idea is to take those 110 controls and describe them in a way so that companies can make the maximum advantage or take the maximum leverage from their existing commercial practices. It is not a prescribed method of security. There is no prescription. This is not a federal-specific security approach, even though it serves federal objectives. And in fact, if you read the documentation within 171, it shows how you can look to international standards, such as ISO 27001, to see whether security that you may have installed following ISO is where and whether and where ISO techniques match the objectives of 171. But it also gives you maps into 853. It doesn't expect you to do it the 853 way, but 853, because it is so elaborate, gives you a lot of information if you choose to look at as to how you could implement these requirements, but you're not obliged to.
Okay, so it sounds to me, and maybe this is, you know, it's almost like you might think I'm crazy to use this term, it's almost like a performance-based contracting approach to cybersecurity. You say these are the goals and things you need to address.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And in several public statements, and perhaps even in this September 21 memorandum from Shea Assad, DoD says so. Yeah. This is like a performance specification. They're saying there's 14 families of things that we think a smart and prudent business should do to protect its information and ours. And we're going to give each of those to you as a single sentence goal. And your job is to do your best to meet them. Right. And the only way that we really have to check whether you're doing your best is to ask you to document kind of where you are when you started, where you see the gaps, and what you're going to do to close the gaps and mitigate the risk. Now, in the nature of such things, we have to expect that that more parts of the government are going to think their information is more important, or they're going to want to know more about what you're doing and not just trust it to you. But where we stand today is that the exercise is really internal, and it is trust-based, and there is no external authentication or accreditation mechanism.
Okay. That is really fascinating, the approach that's being taken. It makes a lot of sense, because the government's always been criticized for prescribing particular solutions or methodologies. And in this field of all fields, like it's an evolving dynamic, do you use those terms, dynamic, you know, field of play, where technology is changing and threats are changing all the time, and solutions to those threats are responding. And it's, you know, a cat and mouse kind of game. Is that fair to say?
Oh, very, very true. And this is something that DoD and NIST are concerned about. Any time that you state controls, and especially if you elaborate upon controls and provide enhancements and mechanics, there's a tendency for enterprises to think that if they can document the existence of the controls and show that they've applied the specified mechanics, that they are in fact delivering security. Well, the controls and the enhancements are all means to achieve security, but they are not, in fact, security by themselves, nor do they equate to security. You know, in truth, if we go outside the government world and we look at very sophisticated international organizations or U.S. businesses, you can see some companies have extremely good security who know nothing about and never consider any NIST standard or practice.
You're right.
There are any number of alternative methods to achieve security. In fact, I've done a program called RSA this February, which is sort of the security specialist conference. And there are people at RSA who say repeatedly that if you take just four or five security principles at the highest level and you execute those really well with smart people and appropriate investment and good organizational discipline, that you can achieve all the security that you would achieve through meeting 400 controls and enhancements of NIST. Right. All are different ways to get to the same thing. And that sort of pulls us back to a point. If we had the Ron Ross here from NIST, or if we had somebody from the DoD CIO's office, if they were sitting right by me, they would say that they expect most companies already have security measures in place which will largely satisfy the objectives of 171 and therefore the requirements of the DFARS. But what they want is for the companies to take those 110 safeguards and essentially to talk through them one by one to see what they've got, what they don't, what they need, and what could be improved. And if it's viewed at that level, it's a rational process dealing with a real threat where there is a known adverse impact to national security.
Yeah, that's really interesting. We have about a couple minutes left, so I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the cloud. And are there any different rules, or you know, just what's the state of play there with regard to cloud?
The answer is yes, and not sure.
Okay.
No, the question.
We need more than 2 minutes, then, don't we?
But are there different rules? No, cloud is really important, and there are some differences of opinion on cloud. For anyone who's interested, I wrote a 15,000-word white paper on exactly this issue, which came out about a year ago. So I'm going to try to condense it into 100 words or close. The DFARS and 171 are focused on what we call on-premises systems. They're basically looking at organizations and attempting to improve the security of the IT systems and to protect the information that is hosted or processed on the IT systems within or on the contractor's premises. In fact, many, if not most companies, are making increasing use of cloud-delivered applications, infrastructure, and platform. And companies are finding that they can improve their functionality, productivity, reduce their operating costs, and so forth by moving to the cloud. Well, DoD is not entirely certain of how to deal with the cloud, at least that's how I would characterize it. So in the current version of the regulations, here's what it says. It says first that if you are operating a cloud as a DoD information system, then you're subject to this whole separate set of rules under the CNSSI, Committee for National Security Systems, and under the Security Requirements Guide, which is produced by the Defense Information Systems Agency, DISA. Let's put that aside, because we're talking about contractors who use cloud either to assist in the function of their business or to host, process, or transmit covered defense information.
Yes.
These are commercial organizations. Now, what basically DoD says is this. It says that if you are a contractor and you allow control technical information, for example, to be put onto the cloud, you are still responsible to meet the 171 requirements, and you are responsible to be certain that your cloud service provider has security that is equivalent to that which is established by something called FedRAMP Moderate. Now, those of you more familiar with the federal information universe know that FedRAMP is an organization founded by a number of federal agencies that has both an approval or accreditation process and a set of security controls which are ratcheted or tailored to the level of information impact. FedRAMP Moderate involves hundreds of controls drawn from 853. It's much more rigorous than 171. But to kind of collapse this back, here's what the rule says. It says if you're contractor A and you are sharing control technical information with a cloud service provider, you, for your own premises systems and for the transport to the cloud, have to meet 171, and you have to be sure that your cloud service provider and the cloud service offering are either approved by FedRAMP or represent the equivalent controls to what would be or has been approved by FedRAMP. And that's not that easy. And that tends to limit the number of cloud service providers that are accessible. And it also, you know, creates both uncertainty and complication. Now, DoD would say, look, you know, if you're going to move the information to cloud, we need to be sure that it's secure. And just because you did move it to cloud doesn't mean that your enterprise is free of vulnerability or risk. That's why they want more.
We've reached the end of the show, but so in a certain sense, it's almost like it's a flow-down requirement.
Well, it is. It's a little awkward because what it tells you, a potentially medium-sized or small contractor, is that you have to tell a big cloud service provider first that they have to comply with some other set of federal standards. And also, you have to tell the cloud service provider that they must cooperate with DoD. They have to make reports, as you would be required to. They have to provide examples of malware. They have to participate or cooperate in forensic investigations. And there are some cloud service providers already FedRAMP accredited who will agree to do that. AWS, Microsoft are just two of several or many examples. But there are an awful lot of commercial cloud service providers who have outstanding security who don't do it that way and are not FedRAMP approved. Right. Now, the final thing to say is this. The DoD has recognized some of the problem. And so they've clarified, for a number of means on this point. They've said that if your use of cloud is incidental to the performance of your government contract, well, then these rules don't apply. So if you are using cloud for payroll, for benefits, okay, for healthcare administration, for your inventory management, for your purchasing system, for your government property system, if you can say the use of cloud is incidental to the performance of your government contract, then the DFARS and 171 do not apply.
Okay. And we could have a whole show about the definition of an incidental, right, Bob? But
right.
I want to thank my guest today, Bob Metzger from Rogers Joseph O'Donnell, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.